Hello and welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and we are joined by, currently right now, he's going to help us with the news as usual, Martin Rip-and-Go Willis.
Rip-and-Go!
Yeah.
It's a new saying.
It's a phrase you term.
We just coined it.
Yeah,
whatever it means.
You coined it. Yeah.
Yeah, but I have no idea what it means. So,
hey.
I was trying to say, let's get going with the show. And I said, yeah.
And you said, let's rip and go. And that's what it is when you coin a phrase. Nobody's ever heard of it. They don't know what the hell it means, but you make something up and then it catches on.
I see. So just remember, folks, if it's on a bumper sticker in front of you, you heard it first here on openminds.tv.
It reminds me of maybe you crouching down in order to leap and sprint. And your pants rip when you crouch, so you rip and then boom, go, you're off.
Wow, I was thinking more like a ripcord, like when you jump out of a plane.
Oh,
you know.
But you don't pull that while you're in the plane.
Well,
that would be bad.
Yeah, sort of on the way out. Some of them do, like they have those things attached to the cable, the wire above.
Oh,
and they just
right,
step out.
That's true.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's simultaneous. Yeah.
So that's what you're thinking with the rip and go. That makes
absolutely
sense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I like that better than my version.
Okay, good.
You know what's funny also about, you know, us when we started off the show and you said, let's rip and go, and I did my countdown, 3, 2, 1, you know, and then we go, which is how you're supposed to do it. You often have variations of that when you do it. But the time was 3:21. So I start to say 3, and I even pause because I look, and I'm reading what I'm saying, 3, 2, 1. How weird is that? Wow.
That is good. Good thing it wasn't, like, you know, 4:18 or something.
Yeah, I take that as auspicious.
Make any sense. Yeah.
It's a good omen.
Wow, yeah.
3, 2, 1.
Play the lottery, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
3, 2, 1, rip and go with Martin Willis of Podcast UFO. But this isn't Podcast UFO. This is Open Mind UFO Radio. But moving on to actually getting into the show and talking about UFOs, which is what the audience is here for. Our guest is awesome. And Martin tuned me into this guest. And he's awesome. Dr. George Gaines. And he's from Pensacola, Florida. He's actually and he'll talk about that. But he had a great UFO sighting, and the actual Air Force personnel came out to interview him, and it's just a really cool story. It has to do with Captain Ruppelt, and that's a bit of a spoiler, but you won't necessarily know. Well, I guess I did just spoil. Oh, well. This is interesting, though. I just like to talk about Ruppelt, because I often do, because he wrote the book Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. He actually was the first person in charge of Project Blue Book. He wasn't the first in the Air Force to investigate. There was Project Sign, Project Grudge, and that turned into Project Blue Book. And his book talks all about that. And I think it's an amazing insight into the phenomenon, or how Air Force, you know, investigated and some of the best incredible cases there. This is also interesting to note. He was born on July 17th, 1923. I was born on July 17th, 1973, exactly 50 years later.
Wow.
Hmm?
Amazing.
I may be. This is possible because I talk about him and his book and I'm so excited about his work. I guess it's possible I could be him reincarnated, don't you think?
I think it's possible.
That would answer my interest, you know, explain my interest in this field.
You know, I was born exactly 9 days, I mean 9 days, 9 years after Roswell. And I'm thinking I've been reincarnated from Roswell.
From a Roswell alien. Wow.
That kind of flows. Yeah.
Yeah. That could be. Wow. That could be. Do you have any memories when you dream? Do you dream of being off planet, on another planet, or anything like that?
Not yet. But I do dream of crashing a lot. So yeah.
In a car or like in a craft?
Well, I don't know. You know, that's maybe why I keep falling off the roof. I'm not sure.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
You do keep falling down and hurting yourself. And that could be why. It's you reenacting this traumatic moment from a past life when you crashed to planet Earth.
Right.
Wow, that's fascinating.
And I wake up saying, Max, Basil, where are you?
Oh, you know, wow. That type of stuff. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I've got to, maybe I should go into the regression, you know, hypnotherapy or something.
Yeah. You know, what's especially interesting about that is that name is very similar to the person who found the crash material in Rossi. His name was actually Brazel. So it's very similar.
Really? Wow. Yeah. That's really amazing coincidence.
It's not quite right on.
Yeah.
But it's close.
Yeah. Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
So getting back to Dr. Gaines real quick here before we move on to the news is not only, you know, did he have this incredible experience while he was younger, what's great and what I love about him is he's a very credible witness. He went on to receive his PhD. He was a professor at Louisiana State University for a while before moving into the corporate world, where he worked for a lot of big corporations as a director or, you know, a corporate officer. So, you know, he's no slouch. This isn't some guy from Circle K or 7-Eleven who just had some weird thing. This is a very, and you'll hear that, a very well-spoken gentleman, and I think who has some great insight into what occurred back then. In the 50s. So I think you're going to really enjoy this guest. Of course, some of you probably already heard him on Martin's show, but some of you have not, because some people might not really like Martin's show very much.
That's
true. You should. I do. But, you know, not everybody has the same taste. So he falls down a lot. Maybe that turns people off. But... But it's really fascinating. So this is a great interview coming up here. But before that, Martin is going to tell us about some UFO news. He's supposed to, anyway.
That's right. British witness photographs spheres. I think it's supposed to say spheres. UFOs following a jet. So this this happened in a part of London, and there was multiple objects, and this guy photographed them. Now, in the article, I did not see a date when this happened. It's case number 82822 of the Mutual UFO Network, a report, and it's in the Fulham section of London. He was walking to a cafe when the incident occurred, and, quote, "I looked up and saw a star-like object about 7 aircraft's widths to the left." Now, that's kind of unusual. He keeps saying aircraft widths. Mm-hmm. To the left of a passenger aircraft. And then he noticed the lights to the right of the aircraft as well. And that was about 7, 12, and 15 aircraft widths to the right. Now, this is a quote by him. "They followed the aircraft and continued to follow it, keeping the same relative distance as it banked greatly toward more a northerly path." Now, he seems like kind of an educated person as he goes on and talks about the way he thought they were balloons at first, reflecting the bright sunlight, and he has seen some at some point, but these remained at a constant speed, had a smooth direction, and all turned relative to each other at the same distance from each other. They also seemed to emit a constant light and did not reflect it, whereas balloons change intensity as they tilt relative to the observer and the sun. So the aircraft wasn't landing at a London airport. It was up about 15 to 20,000 feet, And so he was just watching that. He did catch some pictures. Now, if you look at openminds.tv on the article, you can see they're just little spears of light. I mean, you can definitely see them. And I can understand why he says balloons. That's the first thing I would think of. But, you know, it's kind of a mystery. I don't know exactly when this happened, but I assume that it was fairly soon. This is a fairly recent. It is a daylight sighting.
Yeah, we just posted that story today. And you've got a good point. I should ask Roger when this occurred so we could put that in there because it's good to have the date. I would assume usually it's within the past few weeks when he posts these stories. But yeah, another interesting one. Just from the stills, it could be balloons. But, then again, I've even seen little white dots, and this was a very common in Colorado, and I spoke to quite a few witnesses who had these sort of things, where it looks like a, you know, white balloon, it's something cruising through the air, but they do weird things, like cruise very quickly, maybe stop, maybe do a zigzag, and I've seen that a couple times in Denver. So, wow. Yeah, it's really weird. That's one of the few UFO sightings I've had where I saw these things kind of moving in a way that doesn't, like a balloon would not move. So, yeah, very interesting sighting. However, you said it should be spheres. It shouldn't be spheres because that would be British witness photographs, spheres, UFOs.
Yeah, sphere.
So sphere is describing the
UFOs. UFO spheres?
No, it would be photographs, sphere, UFOs.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah,
sometimes that can happen where you just read it.
I think I flunked that part of.
No, you didn't flunk something, anything.
Maybe, yeah. Oh, well. Okay.
Yeah, so pretty cool. Pretty interesting one. And we haven't, that one luckily had pictures. Roger, of course, wrote more stories last week, and some of them were interesting, but none of them had any pictures or anything. So for those, you know, a lot of people will be like, where's the pictures in the video? Well, you know, here's one. And usually if I feature it, it means that. But there was a funny one where the witness described a disappearing object at treetop level. And this was in the deserts of California. Another really interesting one. But someone did point out there are no trees in the pictures of the area where he was at. There's just shrubbery, and it's a desert. So how could he say treetop level? And that was a really funny, good observation.
Bring me a shrubbery.
Yeah. So, and I wanted to talk about, too, just because it's fun to talk about some of the things in the headlines because we post the UFO headlines on a regular basis. A couple cool things out there. One of those, this is kind of an interesting thought. It was posted by someone from New Atlas, and they said life could jump between TRAPPIST-1's Earth-like planets in decades. So there is a solar system out there called TRAPPIST-1 that has, you know, some exoplanets and some that are in the Goldilocks zone, which could be habitable. And this guy said, you know, the life could go between. So I just think it's kind of fun to think of these solar systems that are out there. In fact, Lee Spiegel wrote a story in the last week for the Huffington Post where there was a quote from a scientist who said, this was a quote, that when you look up in the sky, she says, we now know that every single sun or star you see out there is a solar system. Right. And, you know, some people complained, yeah, we don't know that. Not all of them are. But even the thought of that, the majority of stars you see are actual solar systems. That's mind-boggling. That is amazing to me, I think.
Wow, yes, absolutely. Especially when you look up in the sky and just the amount of stars we can actually see with the naked eye, which is in the thousands, you know.
Yeah.
And that's just a little teeny, teeny, teeny bit. So this TRAPPIST-1, is this like, are they talking like a panspermia type situation where?
I think that's what they mean. They could possibly mean, I guess, intelligent civilizations cruising back and forth or something like that. But yeah, I think it's more like a sharing life type of thing.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
It is. It's really cool. So, in fact, I was going to talk about some of the stories throughout the week, but you know what? There's one today that there's stories today that are cool. So I'll just mention a couple others. One of them is a scientist who does believe aliens may have existed on Earth millions of years ago, and they left. So that's kind of an interesting story. And then another one that has actually been repeated throughout this week. And, you know, I think one of the earlier places you heard that was here at Open Mind. Some of you listeners, right? Exactly, that Ridley Scott believes in aliens. In fact, he's really big into the ancient aliens theory. However, he's been talking about lately how that they'll probably kill us. They'll probably come here and just wipe us out.
Yeah, I'm not really – I really don't think that's
– Really?
Yeah,
you don't think so. That maybe we're a bunch of a-holes and that, you know, another civilizations would be like, you guys are total jerks and would just nuke us or take us out?
Well, I'm not really saying that we don't deserve it. But I'm just saying that if that was the case, we'd probably be wiped out a long time ago, I think.
Well, see, this is why we should act better. And this is why I try to act better is so – if they do come here, they're like, hey, you guys are pretty cool. You know, we're going to hang out with you and let you fly around in our UFOs with us or our spaceships with us and not kill you. And I think that's a good argument to act decently.
Yeah, but they're not going to single you out. I mean, you are.
No, but I mean, as a community, that if we all kind of be cool and we don't be jerk-offs and cut each other off in traffic and stuff, that hopefully we can appeal to the better side of it. The ETs.
Well, I like your optimism, and I agree. I think you set a good example, and I think people should follow in your footsteps.
Well, and here's another thing. I'm a vegetarian,
and true.
I think that's important too, because if aliens were to come here, they could justify eating us because we eat other creatures. And if we eat other creatures that we see less than us, that justifies them eating us if they're more intelligent and evolved than we are.
Wow. What if they come in there in the form of plants?
Oh, geez. That's a good question. Yeah, then they'll be really
PO'd. They'll be singling you out.
Yeah, they may. But you know what? The good thing is that I'll be more familiar with recipes that will make them taste delicious. And so I'll probably want to eat them.
Yeah. So, wow. Take that.
So aliens. They better be careful. You know, they're going to have to justify why I shouldn't eat them.
That's true.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
So much to think about. Amazing. We're some really heavy thinkers here, aren't we?
I know. It's hurting. My brain.
Well, before your brain hurts any further, we should move on and go to the interview. So thank you so much for joining us once again for the news, Martin.
A pleasure as always, sir.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Let's go ahead and talk to Dr. George Gaines. I am super excited to be talking to George Gaines today about his incredible sighting and experience. Welcome to the show, George.
Well, thanks, Alejandro. I'm very glad to be with you today.
Yeah. So I guess let's just get into the incident. My first question being, I mean, before this happened, were you into UFOs at all?
Yes, I was. As a youngster, I was always very interested in astronomy, and in particular reading about UFOs. I guess when the Roswell incident occurred in 1947, I was just about 4 years old, but I remember how excited my mother was about it, and we saw in the newspaper where it said that the, they had actually captured a saucer, and then, of course, a day or two later, that report was debunked. So that made an impression on me as a very little guy, and so I always had a good, healthy interest in the UFO matter, although I'd never seen anything to claim that was a UFO.
Mm-hmm. And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Pensacola, Florida. Mm-hmm. My dad was a naval aviator and during the war, and so that's where he met my mother, and that's where I grew up. So I grew up around... in an area where aircraft in the skies were an everyday occurrence. I mean, right. We had everything you could imagine flying around the skies of Pensacola in the 50s. And so I prided myself on being able to identify all of the aircraft that I saw.
Mm-hmm. I guess back then, in the 50s and 60s, how was the topic dealt with? Was it dealt with more seriousness than today, do you feel, in the media and the general public?
Oh, I think it was taken a little more seriously back in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
because although, you know, there were a lot of, you know, goofy reports that got out, and so it was a mix of that. Today, you just don't see or hear that much about it in the media. I think the media pretty much just ignores the reports unless they are extremely dramatic. I can't remember the last time I heard anything on the news, evening news, that in any way related to UFOs. So I think the media is kind of avoids it because maybe the sensationalism, or maybe they just don't have the interest in digging into it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so I guess let's talk about your sighting, because you were young when this happened.
Yes, I was. I was 13 years old at the time, and I don't know the exact date of the sighting, but it was sometime in mid-July of 1956. It was a hot summer evening in Pensacola, and in Pensacola in those days, there just wasn't much for young people to do. But I had a little girlfriend who we used to, you know, play baseball together and all that kind of stuff. I wouldn't say it was a romantic relationship, but more of a friendship type thing. And so her parents invited me to join them on a drive out to the Pensacola Municipal Airport to watch the airplanes land and take off. Well, that was about as exciting an evening as you could have in Pensacola as a 13-year-old. So the young lady and I went out to the they had just a chain link fence that separated you from the airstrips or the landing area, and her parents went inside to the restaurant there at the airport, and they were having I guess coffee and pie or something like that. And so the young lady and I were out, and I can remember we were kind of hanging on the fence. It was a high chain link fence, taller. I was probably 5'8 or 5'7 somewhere at that time, not to my current height, but so I was kind of hanging on by my fingers, and she was too. And so I, you know, looking up in the air, we were looking for airplanes coming in. And I noticed that the moon was out, and I think Venus and one other planet were very close to the moon. And then I noticed there was an extremely bright light right below the moon. And I mentioned to her, I said, "Wow, look at that light." I said, "That's really bright. I wonder if it's a landing light of an airplane." And it seemed to get brighter and brighter, which would suggest that an aircraft was headed in our direction. And eventually we would turn and see the red and the other colored lights on it and be able to identify it. But it didn't do that. It just got bigger. And then all of a sudden, that big, sort of a yellow glowing golden type light began to divide into what appeared to divide into two lights. And I said, "Whoa," I said, what's happening here? It was like you're seeing a star splitting in duplicating itself. And so all of a sudden there were two lights, and these both lights were about the same intensity. And the second light, you know, it was at first dimmer than the original light, and then it seemed to get brighter. And so we watched these lights, and I began to track them as they were going from north to south. And I said to my friend, look, those lights are moving. It's not a star. They're actually moving. And so the second light then kind of shifted to the above the first light. And they continued to track from, as I was looking, from my left to my right, which was, I was looking to the east, and so they were moving from north to south, and all of a sudden the light on top just took off straight up and disappeared.
Wow.
At an incredible rate of speed. I said, whoa, you know, what is this? And then so we watched the other light, and it tracked across the horizon like it was headed to the area where Pensacola Bay is and Santa Rosa Island, because Pensacola is right on the Gulf, and that light tracked all the way south, and then it took off straight up and out of sight. So both lights were extremely bright, and they moved slowly for a while, and then when they left, they went straight up at incredible rates of speed. Well, I'd looked at a lot of airplanes flying around, and I had never seen anything like that or even remotely close to that in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the sighting. That's all I saw.
Mm-hmm.
And so to kind of put it into perspective, when I got home that night, I told my mother what I had seen. And I'm sure I was very, very excited when I came in. And I just couldn't stop talking about it. She said, well, she called me Skip, and Skip, you need to write all of this down. Write it down so that you'll, record everything. So, yeah, I started writing everything, every detail down, and I worked on that. And that night when I went to bed, I was really afraid for the first time. I can't say the first time in my life, but I was really afraid of something. I didn't know what it was. And so when I got in bed, I looked under my bed, I looked in my closet, because I just had a feeling, I was worried that maybe this was an alien craft, and maybe somehow they knew that I had seen them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's in the imagination of a 13-year-old boy. But I felt that upset about it, that I was looking under the bed and in the closet like there was a boogeyman there waiting for me. So the next day I got up, and I completely rewrote the document, and I put it in the form of a letter. And I told my mother, I said, Mother, I'm going to send this report to the Air Force because they need to know about this. And she said, no, you don't want to do that. I said, well, why not? She says, you'll get us into trouble. You don't want to ever do that.
Funny.
Okay, and so I thought about it, and I said, well, I'm going to do it anyhow. So I put a postage stamp on it, and I didn't know who to address it to at first. So I said, well, the nearest Air Force base is Eglin Air Force Base, which is about 45 miles away to the east. So I addressed it to UFO Investigation Office, Eglin Air Force Base, Florida, and that was before we had zip codes or anything. And I said, I'll mail it. I guess they'll figure out where to send it. Put a return address on there and everything. So I mailed it the next day. I don't recall exactly what day of the week it was, but it was certainly a weeknight. And I would say, let's say I mailed it on a Monday or Tuesday. Well, it seemed like it was the following Saturday. When I was getting up and getting ready, I was a swimmer, and so I was going to swim practice down at the swim club. And so the phone rang about 8:10, and I answered the phone because that was my job at the house, to answer the phone. And so this guy on the other end said, may I speak to George Gaines? I said, well, this is he. He says, is this the same George Gaines that's 13 years old? Yes, sir, that's me. He says, same George Gaines that lives at 820 West Marino Street? I said, that's correct, that's me. He said, are you the same George Gaines that sent a report to the Air Force about something you saw in the sky earlier this week? I said, yes, that's me. He says, well, George, you going to be home this morning? I said, oh, no, I'm not going to be at home. I've got swim practice. I'm getting ready to go to swim practice. There was a slight pause, and the man said, George, just sit tight. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right over.
Wow.
So I said, I better tell my mother.
So what did you fear more at that point, the Air Force or your mom?
My mother. Because I knew the immediate reaction was not going to be good. I said, Mother, I said, you remember that that letter I said I was going to send to the Air Force and you asked me not to send it? She said, yeah. I said, well, I sent it. She says, who was that on the phone? I said, I think it's the Air Force. Oh, no. She says, you didn't. I said, yes, I did. I said, they said they're coming over now. Well, while we were having this conversation, and she was trying to calm down a little bit, and my grandmother used to sit in the living room and like to sit there and just look out the window. She'd look at all the cars coming by. And just as I was talking to my mother about it, she says, oh, they're here now. So up drove, and this blew my mind at the time, a 1956, this was the year, 1956, white Cadillac, four doors, unmarked, no markings on it. And I only knew of one family in Pensacola that owned a Cadillac, anything like that. I mean, that was really rare to see that pull up. And out of the Cadillac come two guys dressed as Air Force officers, and they had their summer uniforms on, which were khaki-type uniforms. So they came up to the door. My mother was very gracious, and, you know, because my father had been a pilot in the Navy, so she knew, you know, military protocol. She greeted them, and they, you know, showed identification, asked if they could come in and ask me some questions. Oh, sure, come on in. So we sat down in the living room for maybe 30 minutes and had sort of a general discussion. And my mother was in there, and so at that point, the man in charge, who was a captain, told the lieutenant, the second guy, go out in the car and bring some stuff in. So then it was obvious that this was going to take more than a few minutes.
Mm.
And, the lieutenant brought in a woolen sack reel-to-reel tape recorder. And that tape recorder started running at about 8:30 in the morning, and it didn't stop running until around 3 p.m. that afternoon.
Wow.
Left. So it was a long interview, probably 6 hours in total, I'm guessing. The first part of the interview was trying to confirm what I had seen. And so the lieutenant, who was a very tall guy and had salt and pepper black hair with just a little bit of gray in it, he was probably in his mid-30s. And he stood up, had a very military bearing, stood up there, he had a pointer, and he was pointing to this chart and asking me all kinds of technical questions. I didn't have a clue what he was talking about, but the captain, who was much more relaxed in his demeanor, in fact, he had his blouse open, his jacket was open because it was very warm that day, and of course, we had no air conditioning in the house, and I know my grandmother brought in ice water for us, so they were drinking ice water, and the captain was sweating, and so so was the lieutenant. But the captain would sort of interpret what he said. What I think the lieutenant is saying is this, and he would explain it to me. I said, oh, yeah, this is it. So they tried to get me to identify the size of the objects, the speed of the objects, the distance of the objects. I had no way to relate to any of that, to give them any kind of satisfactory answer that they were looking for. So this went on for quite a while. Then they brought in a movie projector, and they showed me movies of various UFO sightings. And he said, have you ever seen this before? I said, yeah, I saw that in, I saw a movie one time. Mm-hmm. That's the same film that I saw in the movie. And, well, did it look like that? I said, well, not quite. And so the movie probably lasted, I don't know, 45 minutes, but it was just a whole bunch of clips that were put together showing various sightings. Then I don't remember taking a break at all, but they asked my mother if we could go to a room where we could, they could talk to me privately. And so we had a small den that was off to the side. It had a door to it, so we moved everything into the den, and they closed the door and locked it so
wow.
that we wouldn't be disturbed. And so the questioning went on, and they had a series of what I call, looked like scrapbooks or big thick notebooks. And in there they had pictures of every kind of, you know, aircraft or alien craft that you could imagine. And they were trying to get me to find something that looked like what I saw. And I said, well, it's kind of like this, but did it have... And then they were always trying to get me to change my story. But the only story I knew was the truth. The only thing I could report was what I had actually seen, and so I stuck to my story, even though they, you know, tempted me to say, you know, did you see when the craft came close and before it landed? I said, no, it didn't land. Well, did you see any portholes at all or any shape to the craft? I said, no, it was just a very bright light. Well, did you see any people looking out at you? Did anybody get out of it when it landed? I said, no, it did not land. I mean, it was constantly suggesting to me various things that might have happened that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, all I had was my story, which was the truth, and I stuck to it. Finally, we'd gone through a bunch of these books, and there was one book that remained that I had not seen. And I was keeping a close eye on them because I figured when we get to the last book, these guys are going to leave. Because I was kind of ready to get out of there.
Right.
Because I was tired of telling the same thing over and over again. I was bored with my own story, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, well, he says, you told me, George, that you didn't see any aliens at all. I said, that's right, I didn't. He says, well, let me just show you this book, and if you see anything in there that makes you feel differently, just let me know. So this was a scrapbook or picture book of aliens. And there were drawings of aliens, colored sketches, pencil sketches. Some looked like insects. Some looked like, Godzilla. So just every kind you could imagine. Would they look like that? No, I never seen that. Never seen that. Finally, we got flipped to a picture. It showed it looked like a dead alien on a gurney. And it looked very similar to what I saw many years later with the alien autopsy
mm-hmm.
photographs. And it was just a little guy, you know, with the big head and big eyes. And it looked like he had some pretty severe chest wounds, like he'd been injured. And when I saw that, I said, whoa, I said, that looks real. And he says, is that what you saw? I said, no, I didn't see that. I said, but that picture looks real. Is it? And I asked him, I said, is it real? He says, well, he says, it looks real, doesn't it? I said, yeah, is it real? He says, well, it looks real to me, but I can't tell you that it's real.
Hmm.
So at that point, they wrapped up their stuff. They went to the door. My mother saw them out, and the captain said, now, I'd like you all to not say anything to anybody about this. There's no point in it. Please just don't ever discuss our visit with you all, with anybody, ever. And he looked at me, he said, George, you got that? I said, yes, sir, I do. And so I remained silent until 1999.
Wow.
So
43 years later.
Yeah, 43 years I began to talk. because I went to my oldest daughter was very interested in the MUFON organization, and she went to the she was the youngest member of the local MUFON chapter.
Wow.
And everybody just loved her there because she had seen something and talked about it, and she loved to go to the meetings. And Ed and Francis Walters were there, and all sorts of. Are we still there?
Yes.
Hello.
Can
okay.
You hear?
Anyhow, it was a lot of famous people were there at the time, so. They had a Christmas party, and she begged me to go with her. Well, she was only in high school, so I said, okay, I'll go with you to the Christmas party. And so I met a couple of Air Force officers there, and they asked me what I was doing there, and I told them, my daughter's here. And so we began to talk. I said, well, I don't know if I should even talk about this, but here's what happened to me. And they were just really, really excited to hear this because they were quite a bit older than me at the time. I guess they probably are deceased by now. And they told me a lot. They said, I guess these guys came over from Eglin, huh? They said, no, they didn't. Eglin had no investigating authority. They would have come down from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and they would have flown into NAS Pensacola, and then they would have gotten a car and come out to see you. I'm thinking, well, whose car would that have been? Said probably, the commanding officer or the admiral in charge, would have been his private vehicle. I said, wow. about a year or two ago, I began to do more research because I wondered who these guys were.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to dig on the internet, and there I found a picture of Captain Edward J. Ruppelt, who was in charge of Project Blue Book from 1950 to 1953. The captain who interrogated me was, in fact, the same man. I recognized him immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately. When I saw the picture, I said, that's him. That's the guy. He had kind of a pudgy face, just a little bit of a pudgy face,
mm-hmm.
and it was absolutely him. And then I went through some other pictures, and then I found the Lieutenant Robert Olson, who was his sidekick or his administrative officer. And he and Olson investigated many, many sightings together. Now, what I've learned since then is that Ruppelt and Olson both left the Air Force. They retired in 1953. So this is 3 years later, and Ruppelt, in 1956, was living in Los Angeles and employed as an engineer in a secret project at Northrop Aviation. I don't know where Olson went or whether he's still alive or not. I doubt it because this was a long time ago, and he'd be probably in his late 80s or early 90s. But so I began to do a little more research on Captain Ruppelt, and I wondered, okay, he's been out of the Air Force for 3 years. He's working for a private contractor. What is he doing? Who called him to investigate
exactly.
this? I mean, he's a civilian. Why did he show up on my front doorstep with his old sidekick, Lieutenant Olson, to do all this, to do this investigation? And so the only thing I could conclude is that Ruppelt was still involved with Project Blue Book, and some of the research that I've done shows that he was involved in some way with them, at least as a consultant. And I happened to come across today a letter addressed to Donald Kehoe, former retired major,
mm-hmm.
well-known name in the UFO business. It was sent to Don Kehoe by Ed Ruppelt. And I'll just read this first part to you because I think it tells exactly what I've been saying.
Mm.
He says, "Dear Don, thanks for your recent letter. If the situation were such that I could conveniently do it, It would be interesting to work with NICAP. That's one of the old precursors of MUFON.
Mm-hmm.
But as things stand right now, I just can't. Northrop didn't have anything to do with my decision. Strictly my own, incidentally. It's difficult to give you a good, solid reason why I've decided to stay as far out of the UFO controversy as possible, because I can't get specific about my work. You'll just have to take my word that I have a good reason. So what he's saying is that it's not that Northrop wouldn't let him be involved. He has another reason that he can't explain, and it has to do with his work. And I imagine his work is being an out-of-the-way investigator of UFOs for the Air Force.
Hmm.
Or some other organization.
Right.
I also found out that it was fairly common for UFO investigators, whether they be from the FBI or CIA, to wear military uniforms when they did this, because it was just easier to gain access to people's homes, and people back in the 50s certainly respected the military, and it was just gave easier access. So I don't know who Ruppelt was actually working for.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that my case found its way into Project Blue Book, into the archives. And I found this about, 7 or 8 years ago. There's what's called a Project 10073 report. And that's the debrief, it's the synopsis of an investigation. I found it, and I wish that I'd made a copy of it, because in there, the determination was that what I had observed was, in fact, a mid-air refueling.
Really?
That was the official story. I don't think for a minute that Captain Ruppelt believed that that was a mid-air refueling, because mid-air refuelings don't look like that. And he said the refueling was occurring over 110 miles away.
Hmm.
That was a little bit strange. So that was the convenient explanation. And I've gone back to the archives to try to find that Project 10073 report form, and it's missing. And in there it just says it has the date of July 23rd, 1956, which is the date that they actually filed the report, probably the Monday following the Saturday meeting, which meant they're good bureaucrats. They did their paperwork. And it says the case is missing. So there's nothing there anymore.
How interesting.
Wonder where it went.
Yeah, and I have all of the Blue Book files on my computer here, actually, and I'm looking at July 1956, and let's see here. There's one from Jacksonville, Florida, from July, and then Ocala and St. Augustine. Were you near any of those areas?
No, it's Pensacola. It when I do the search, it comes up under Pensacola.
Oh, it does. Yeah, okay, because I was looking at some of those others, so I'll look here while we're talking. But what an incredible experience. Now, did your friend's father also, was he there?
No, it was just me and the little girl.
Uh-huh. And was she questioned?
Well, she was, but here's the funny part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
She was terribly nearsighted.
Oh.
Terribly nearsighted child, and there was a little bit of romantic interest on her part, and maybe some on mine, I'll admit. And so she wouldn't wear her glasses because she thought she was less attractive with glasses on. So she told me afterwards, later in life when we were talking about this, because she had tried to write up a report as well, and her report was just you know, just ridiculous, because she said, George, she says, I was embarrassed because I didn't have my glasses on. I didn't see anything that you were talking about. So my witness was useless to me.
Mm-hmm.
She was questioned for about 15 minutes, and they sent her home. I think they figured out that she didn't know anything. So.
Yeah, not much to contribute there. Pretty incredible. Now,
yeah.
The time...
But we,
Go ahead.
I was going to say, she and I are still friends over the years and dear friends, and we stay in touch. We laugh about this from time to time. And I even sent her a picture of Captain Ruppelt. I said, this is the guy. And she says, I was in and out so fast, I wouldn't know who was there.
Uh-huh.
She said, I remember it was two of them.
Yeah. So, it's pretty incredible the effort they took. I mean, that talking to you all day, recording, and all the discussion that they had, it seems like they were taking your report very seriously.
Yeah. I mean, I've shared the information with, you know, some experts in the field. I said, look, there's nothing unique about your report. And I said, well, it must, you know, they said there must have been something in the letter that you sent that caught their attention, something that you don't remember that was in that letter that tweaked their interest. I said, I don't know if that's the case or not, but, you know, they said, you know, on the face of it, that report just should have been ignored. Mm-hmm. Because they weren't investigating everything. In July of 1956 was one of the hottest months in the history of Project Blue Book.
Mm-hmm.
I think they had over 700, around 750 reports in the month of July. Well, now Ed Ruppelt couldn't have done 750 investigations.
Well, and at that time, that's the same year his book came out. And when his book came out, he was. It's apparent in the first version that he still. To him, the UFOs were an open question and a mystery.
That's right. But the second edition, which came out a couple of years later, and some even wonder if Ed Ruppelt had written it, he took a different posture, took more of a debunking attitude.
At least a skeptical one. So in 56, yeah. It seems he was still very interested in the topic, and it could be that they just had to cherry pick, you know, choose the best of the best and the most credible, and maybe you just came across as credible to them.
Could be, and the of course the book came out, I believe, just the month after. I believe it came out in August of 56, so he would have already... you know, had the material. I mean, the book would have been in press at that time, because printing in those days took a long, long time. I mean, you know, 6 months to proof and all that. So I'm sure it was all in press since it came out only a couple weeks after the meeting. But of course, Ed Ruppelt had, I don't know when he had his heart, he had a heart attack in 1956,
mm-hmm.
which was year he came to visit me. I suspect that the heart attack had occurred before the visit. And the reason I say that is because I noticed he was sweating profusely, and Olson did all of the legwork. Ruppelt never got out of the chair, except when we moved to the other room, and he stayed seated the entire time. Olson was up and around, you know, always moving, always active. Olson was looked like a fighter pilot. I mean, he was lean and taut and probably about 6'1", and just really very sharp military bearing.
Mm-hmm.
Ruppelt was much different personality.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, Ruppelt suffered the fatal heart attack in 1960, just... 3.5 years after he was in Pensacola with me.
Mm-hmm. So I guess
37.
How did you take this? So you moved on with your life, of course. Like you said, you didn't share that story until 1999. What was the impression you left? I mean, what was in your thoughts? Did this confirm anything to you, or did you feel that, wow, the Air Force must know more than they're sharing with the public?
I felt they knew a lot more than what they were sharing with the public.
Mm-hmm.
Just how much more, I don't know.
Yeah.
I didn't feel that that Ruppelt and Olson had any answers. I felt that they were still they were really investigators,
mm-hmm.
and looking to find out, you know, what was there. I didn't have a feeling that they knew what was in Area 51 hanging in, you know, in a hangar somewhere. I just don't think that they were privy to that.
Mm-hmm.
That was my impression, that they were they might have known quite a bit, or they might have heard, but I just don't think I think they were in the dark,
mm-hmm.
about what could possibly have been going on at Wright Pat.
And then, what do you think of the photo they showed you?
Oh, the alien autopsy,
mm-hmm.
photo.
Yeah, all these years later.
Well, when I saw it, I guess the next time I saw it, I was probably, you know, 40-something years old. I said, whoa, I've seen that one before.
Hmm. Yeah.
I saw that when I was 13 years old. So they had some stuff, and, you know, whether it was leaked out or something, you know, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my regret, of course, is nothing I could have done about it, is that you know, of course, Ed Ruppelt passed in 1960. I was in high school, or I guess at the time, graduating from high school. And I would have loved to have met him again. He was a complete officer and a gentleman. And in many ways, look at my late father. He reminded there's a lot of things that he reminded me of my dad about. And he was just a very, very engaging, helpful person. And although he was trying to get me to change my story, it was never done in kind of a, you know, like you see these cop interrogations where,
mm-hmm.
you know, screaming at you and, well, you told me this and that. I mean, it was always very gentle. He knew how to conduct an interview,
mm-hmm.
and did it very well. He had a brother, who lived not too far from me down in, I believe in the Sarasota area, who died in, I think, around 2010. And I wish that I could have reached out to him before he died. Of course, I didn't know that it was Ed Ruppelt at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a recent discovery for me. I would have liked to have met his brother.
Yeah.
Who was 87 when he passed. I'm sure his wife passed, in fact, I know she passed. He did have two daughters who should be alive today. I've tried to, you know, find them, but to no avail.
Mm-hmm. Now, his questioning, trying to get you to change your story, sounds like to me, and I'd love to hear if you agree with this or not, more of a method of checking your story. So, for instance, seeing
yes.
how easily...
Yeah.
Yeah. You could be manipulated.
Right. He would say something that was incorrect, and then I would correct him.
Mm-hmm.
He'd say, now, there were three lights, right? I said, no, just two. Okay, mm-hmm. two lights. And they were orange in color? No, not really orange, more golden, you know, okay. Red? Were they red? No, not. I can't say red, no, more golden, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then you come back and you say, now these red lights that you said, no, they weren't red, they were golden. It was, you know, okay, kind of like Inspector Clouseau a little bit. You know?
Yeah. So how did your mom react when they left?
Well, I mean, she was pleased. She said, wow, that was really something. And she said, now remember, we're not going to talk about this. They told us don't talk. So I said, no, I'm not saying anything to anybody about
uh-huh.
it. But, and she and I talked about it from time to time. And, of course, she's passed now. So, and the last time I talked to her, a couple of years before her death, I guess this would have been like in 2002 or three. I said, Mother, try to tell me, what do you remember about these guys? She says, well, I remember that the lieutenant was very dashing and handsome. And that he was, you know, quite good looking. And of course you would remember that.
Yeah.
What else do you remember? Well, the other guy, she says, he was just kind of sloppy, I thought. Yeah, that's because he was kind of slouched down in the chair. And you look at pictures of Ed Ruppelton, you can kind of see him slouching in a chair.
Especially if you're right and he had heart problems.
Yeah, I think he had developed some heart problems.
Right.
Now, whether that's really what killed him or not, I don't know. But that was the story.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some question. I mean, the neighbor, he had a guy that he rode with to Northrop every day. They commuted from. They were next door neighbors, and both worked at Northrop, apparently in the same secret project. Which is kind of interesting that they would put them side by side in a neighborhood. And his wife, when she was, I think she lived to be 90-something, she claimed that Ed Ruppelt died under the most suspicious of circumstances and that she never accepted the idea that he died of a heart attack.
Interesting.
So
now... Are you participating more in going to with your daughter to these MUFON meetings?
Well, we're going to go to one in Lakeland, Florida, in June.
Uh-huh.
My calendar is clear on that date, and I've got dear friends that live in Lakeland we hadn't seen in about a year. So I said, you know, we're going to go to the meeting. I think it's a Wednesday morning or something like that, and then we're going to go to, after the meeting, we're going to have lunch with our friends, so we're going to do that. But I've generally kind of tried to stay out of it, not for any particular reason. It still is a burning interest of mine, and, you know, it's like anything else. You kind of get, like I knew I was going to do the interview today, I said, well, I'm going to look online and see if I can find any new stuff. And so I did find this letter.
Right, that's great.
Ruppelt to Don Kehoe that kind of, in a mysterious way, says, I can't really tell you about my work. But it's not Northrop that says I can't do it.
Yeah, really interesting. So and you, I mean, had a very professional career. You were a professor at one point, is that correct?
Right, yeah, I have a doctorate in educational psychology. My specialization was educational and psychological measurement. So I taught in the LSU system for almost 10 years, and then I went to work in the private sector in what I call market intelligence work. So I'm basically a scientist and a numbers guy. Hard-nosed facts, I mean, you know.
And how do you think... your peers would have reacted had you have shared this story, or at least, and especially the alien picture?
Well, I had one boss that I was very close to, and I just one day we were talking, and somehow the subject came up, and I said, "Well, I had an experience of sighting when I was 13 years old," and he said, "Really?" He says, "Well, I had." A real frightening experience about 5 years ago.
Wow.
And I said, did you report it? He says, hell no. He says, I didn't want to lose my job, you know, because he was working for a power company. And he said that, you know, he was doing some investigation. And he said, you know, he talked to some people about it. He said, well, maybe it must have been swamp gas. He said, George, that was not swamp gas. He said, I know what that looks like. He said, it was a craft that was flying that had landed in the woods and took off. So, but, you know, every once in a while, you know, you'll get that. Somebody else will, one person will share, and then somebody else will say, well, you know, I saw something once, too. But generally, I don't really bring it up.
Yeah, it's fascinating your coworkers, your colleagues' reaction, as well as your mother's, and it's something I've heard quite a bit. This fear of reporting what they had seen, and a lot of people fearing the government. And that's one aspect of your story that's kind of incredible to me, that even I hear this to this day. A lot of times people will say, I want to report my sighting, but do you think I'll get in trouble? But it's interesting to hear that your mother way back then had the same concern.
Oh, yeah, she was definitely concerned about it. It could cause some problems, and you know, it could be that you know, it, I mean, although my parents were divorced at the time, my father did some very secret work for the CIA. He was you know, in the military, and you know, involved in some, at the end of the war, in some very, very secret projects regarding weaponry, and so, you know, she stayed in touch with him and that. So it could be just that, you know, don't talk about this. I mean, when I talked to my dad about it, I asked my dad late in life, when we became, I guess, friends again. I mean, I never really knew him as a little kid.
So you didn't tell him back when it happened?
Oh, no. I had no contact with my father at all. I probably wouldn't have known him if I'd passed him on the street.
Wow.
But I was in my 40s when I really got to know my dad, and it was a couple of years before he passed, and I brought the subject up with him. And I said, Dad, if, you know, in all your years of flying, and he had a tremendous number of air hours in multi-engine and in rotary engine aircraft. I said, have you ever seen anything like that? He says, oh, he says, yeah. He said, you mean like Foo Fighters? He says, oh, yeah, when I flew bombers over Germany, he said, the Foo Fighters, they flew with us all the time.
Wow.
I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, I can talk about that because that's all out in the open. Everybody knows about that. He said, but, yeah, they we were debriefed and talked about it and gave reports. And he said, they just flew. They were out on my wing almost, not every mission, but most missions, they were out there.
Wow. Okay?
Kind of like they were flying with us or guiding us to the target.
Hmm. How interesting.
I said, well, and I asked him this question. I said, Dad, I said, you know, there must be people inside the government who know the truth about all this stuff. I said, how in the world can they keep the lid on it? And he looked at me and he says, you know, with his steel green eyes, he said, I'll tell you something, son. He says, I'll tell you how they keep secrets. They tell you that if you ever talk about this, you will be killed, and every member of your family will be killed. And he said, that's how secrets are kept.
Hmm. Wow. That is kind of scary, huh?
Kind of scary.
Yeah.
And he said, I've told you this. He says, don't ever ask me again about it.
Wow.
Yes, now, sir.
Along those lines of, like, intelligence and maybe even misinformation, have you ever thought of the possibility that they showed you that picture so that you would maybe, as a seed, like, so you would go out and talk to people and tell people, you know, the Air Force showed you this picture of an alien to create some sort of mythology?
Well, but then they told me not to talk about it, and we really respected that, so...
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. I mean, that was one of the better pictures in there. I mean, the other things were really goofy looking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it looked like something you'd see in a comic book. You know, these aliens. You know, an art, like the imagination of an artist.
Right.
So I said, yeah, I just dismissed those as being ridiculous when I saw them.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you know, I've seen some of, yeah, I've seen that before in a comic book.
Right.
Well,
this is a fascinating story. Thank you so much for sharing this.
Well, I'm glad to share it, and I have nothing to hide. I mean, it's the truth. You know, that's the same story that I told a long, long time ago, and I can't figure out how many years ago, but I need a calculator to do that. But, you know, it's the only story. It's what happened. It's what I saw, and... maybe it was mid-flight refueling. I don't think so. Maybe it was balloons. I don't think so. I think it was, you know, something from out of this world. I mean, that's the conclusion that I reached as a 13-year-old, and at age 74, I don't feel any differently about my conclusion today than I did then.
Mm-hmm. And that would be a lot of effort that these gentlemen spent just to debrief you about a refueling.
That's right. I'd like to talk to somebody else who'd actually been debriefed to see if it was, you know, by Ed Ruppelt and Bob Olson. I'd love to talk to somebody that had the same experience, and you know, I might bring back some stuff that I've forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hopefully someone comes forward, and I'll let you know if I hear from anyone.
Yeah, I've just never run across anybody who ever said they were visited.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. This was great.
Well, thank you, Alejandro. It was a pleasure being with you today on the program.
Thank you so much to George for being on the show. I am sure you all found him very fascinating, as much as I did. Really, really cool stuff. And, of course, I said it before at the top of the show, and you know I'll say it again. Get Ruppelt's book on the report on UFOs, Unidentified Flying Saucers. In fact, I don't think I mentioned that he's the guy who coined the phrase UFO. So that comes from the Air Force, for those of you who are unawares. And so it wasn't until, you know, the 1950s, early 1950s, that phrase came into existence, is what I'm trying to say. And he talks about this in the book, and the reason is because flying saucers isn't as descriptive. Not all of these things are saucers that people are seeing, as people know, because of course Roger is always posting stories about triangles. You know, we've also got stories about all kinds of different shapes, of course, in craft. And even George's craft was not a saucer shape. So, yep, that's why they chose UFO eventually. So, thank you so much to George for being on the show. Also, thank you to Martin Willis for letting me know about George and also joining us on the news. So, he gave us UFO news that you can see on openminds.tv. Those other news items that I talked about, you can also see at openminds.tv. We post UFO news daily, and we post headlines daily. So, if you're following us on Twitter at openminds.tv, or you're on our Facebook page, and that's at Open Minds Production, then you'll be able to see our stories. Or if you follow me personally, you'll be able to see those headlines that we post on. Or if you just go to the website. So you have daily news about UFOs there. And then, of course, the Roger stories. And then once in a while, I'll post a story. And so we've got just so much good stuff for you to see. Now, if you want to keep up on what we're doing, including like when we have videos posted that are lectures from the UFO Congress on our video on demand page, you can go to openminds.tv, and in the upper right, you'll see an Open Minds newsletter box where you can just put in your email, and then we send out biweekly emails on what we've been up to. So if you'd rather follow us that way, that's cool too. So whatever way you like to get your UFO news, we've got you covered. I guess we don't Snapchat. I do, with like my family and friends and stuff, just to send goofy Snapchat stuff. So sorry about that if you're a Snapchatter. Just, you know, you also tweet probably too. So tweet us or get our tweets. So multiple ways to get info. Lots of cool stuff. In fact, I don't think I've even mentioned in our video on demand, we do have Richard Dolan's video up from the conference. So Richard Dolan did a special talk that he put together just for the UFO Congress on the media, so you'll be able to see that on our video on demand. Some of you might be thinking, yeah, but we have to pay for video on demand. Well, come on, guys. That's the only thing you got to pay for. You don't got to pay for our stories on our website. You don't got to pay for this wonderful podcast that you enjoy so much. The only thing that we do ask, and it's so low, it's like $5 for goodness sakes a month to see hundreds, literally now, hundreds of videos. So come on, if you don't mind, please go on there. $5 is all it is, $5 a month. I give $5 a month to PBS, also a local, nonprofit radio station. And so you can do that for us, please. Don't make me beg. So it's just a few bucks to be able to see some of these cool videos. You'll see Richard Dolan. You'll see James Fox. You'll see a lot of other really cool people on our video on demand. So please check that out. Otherwise, that's it for today. We're going to have another show coming up next week. I do have a vacation coming up in a few weeks, so I won't have a show then. But that's not till the beginning of next month. It's crazy to say that it's already May. So I brag, all through the winter about the great weather out here. But soon you won't hear me doing that because it gets really hot and our weather will be nothing to brag about. But luckily we have a few more days of decent stuff here before the cooker gets turned on. But I hope you all enjoy your summers wherever you all. And be sure to, you can even have a nice day outside listening to the radio and listen to our next show next week. So I want to thank again Martin Willis for joining us for the news, George Gaines for sharing his great story with us, and then also thank Caleb Hanks for the opening and close music, which you're going to hear very soon here. I also want to thank you, the listeners and the readers of OpenMinds.tv. I am super very, very grateful for you returning to listen to the show and visiting us at our website and enjoying the fruits of our efforts. It's just wonderful to have a good big community out there of like-minded people to share stuff with. So thank you all so much for your patronage. Until next week, adios muchachos.